WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, In the Name of the Father, stars Daniel Day-Lewis as a young Irishman wrongly convicted of being an IRA terrorist. The movie is based on the autobiography of my guest Jerry Conlon. Conlon, who grew up in Belfast, was accused with three friends of bombing a pub in Guildford, England. They became known as the Guildford Four. They were sentenced to life in 1975. Conlon's aunt, Annie Maguire, and her family were convicted of making bombs. Conlon's father, who was convicted as a co-conspirator, died in prison in 1980. After his death, there were calls to review the case. It was finally reopened in 1989 after Conlon's lawyer discovered that the prosecution had suppressed evidence which proved everyone's innocence. On today's show, we're going to hear from Jerry Conlon and the director of the new film about him, Jim Sheridan. I asked Jerry Conlon why he thinks he was accused of the bombing.
I think I was accused of the bombing because the British police were in a state of fear, and Britain had developed the siege mentality down to an IRA mainland campaign. And it was a question of rounding up people, and my name was one of the names that was thrown into the hat, and subsequently I was arrested, and I seemed to fit the bill for them. I came from West Belfast. I was unemployed. They tortured me. I signed a confession.
Why was your name in the hopper? Why was your name on the list?
Well, I was working with some friends in London who happened to be arrested, and they'd been brutalised in the police station, and it had to be seen to be believed, the atmosphere and the amount of brutality that was in the police station, to understand why people could confess to something they didn't do. And obviously these people had been given such a bad time that they admitted something they didn't do. And of course, when you get that sort of situation, it's sort of roller coasters. And to stop the brutality, all sorts of names be threw up, people who they know and people who they know well and people who they know very vaguely.
One of the things you got to understand is that if you were being interrogated, and if you knew members of the IRA, and if you were not in the IRA, the last thing you could do is give their names because you're afraid of them. So people were actually looking, when they themselves broke down, they were looking to find people who they thought it was ridiculous would be tried.
So they'd name names that were absurd.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, yeah.
That's why they named Annie Maguire, because her house was decorated with Churchill and Queen
with
of
British
England.
British memorabilia. You know, they had Annie Maguire had pictures of the Queen and the bust of Winston Churchill and that. And it was so ludicrous that these people could actually be involved in something like that. And that's how their names were brought up. And it was when you're being tortured and a name crops up, it's very easy to develop it into a real thing.
Jerry Conlon, at your trial, you write in your memoir that you almost thought the defense should have brought up that the IRA didn't want undisciplined idiots like you in its ranks.
The police should have investigated our background before they brought us to trial, and they would have known defense wouldn't have needed to bring that sort of material up.
What was it about you and the IRA that didn't go together?
Well, probably rock and roll. I grew up in a house that was full of music, and there was a rock and roll background to it. And I don't know, maybe I was sort of like one of the lone hippies where I came from, and all I wanted was a good time, and I didn't perceive a good time to be standing on corners checking out army foot patrols with the possibility of shooting them. I preferred much going to a dance hall or going to the betting shop and having the betting horses and chasing women. You know, that was my priorities. My priorities was never for United Ireland. I became politicised later on, you know, and it was through imprisonment that happened.
You were also a small-time thief. What did the IRA think of people like you who robbed to get some extra money?
Well, I didn't regard myself. I regarded myself as a small-time survivor, you know. Like, mm-hmm. Unemployment was exclusively one-sided where I came from, you know. Discrimination in jobs and housing is now well known. But in 1969, it wasn't. So, like, you were having a lot of bombed-out places with all sorts of sellable goods in it. And I thought I was just doing a good job for myself, saying I couldn't get normal employment.
In the movie, there's a scene where someone from the IRA is about to kneecap you, about to shoot you in the knee because you were causing such chaos by stealing. But then in the movie, your father comes in and talks the IRA out of it and rescues you. Did something like that actually happen?
On several occasions. My father was a well-respected member of the community. He was very gentle and very kind, and he was also... For the people who did have a job in West Belfast, he used to fill out the tax forms for them, you know, and he was recognised as a gentle and kind person. And I fell foul of the IRA several times through taking scrap metal to sell from buildings, through what they termed antisocial behaviour, like, and that would come under the term of doing Rod Stewart impressions on the Falls Road, you know.
Doing Rod Stewart impressions would be antisocial behaviour?
Well, if you sang like I did, it would be termed antisocial.
No, what did you and other friends of yours who were apolitical think of the IRA?
We didn't really think anything of them. You know, the whole thing was, it was 1969, Woodstock had happened, there was this whole start of the glam rock era, and all of a sudden you're caught up in a war, you know, and you either joined the IRA or you didn't join the IRA. And my house was full of religious pictures of Jesus Christ and the Blessed Virgin Mary, when most other houses were filled with pictures of 1916 Republican heroes. And I didn't, I had no intention. I was caught up in a rock and roll theme. I was just a young kid who wanted to have a good time, and I found myself walking a precarious tightrope between these two elements who were at war with each other.
So when you were picked up for the Guildford pub bombings, what did the authorities do to you to get you to confess?
Well, the first thing they did was they asked me my name, and when I said my name was Jerry Conlon, this police officer hit me in the face and broke my nose. So that was the start of it. And then I went through a further 6 days of torture. I was beaten every day. I was held naked. The clothes that I was originally arrested in were destroyed by the police because they were saturated with my own blood. And obviously the police had destroyed them because they didn't want them to be exhibited at my court appearance. I was held naked. I was given no food. There was policemen running about with guns. There was Alsatian dogs prowling the corridors. It was a whole time of absolute terror in the police station. I was taken out from the police station. I had a gun put to my head. I was told that my family were going to be murdered. You know, like, it was just incredible. Like, I couldn't believe, when I left Belfast on the plane, I was convinced that I was going to be treated correctly, that English policemen, rather than Northern Ireland policemen, would see how nonsensical this was. You know, like, here was this kid from West Belfast who could be checked out on a computer, whose family had not been touched by the Troubles. There was internment, which meant people were arrested and detained without trial for, it could be anything from a month to 2 or 3 years. And yet my family had never been involved. They had never had their home searched. So, like, if the police just had took a bit of time and checked out our backgrounds, you know, they could have seen, like, how stupid it was in arresting the type of people they were arresting. They were arresting people from squats who were like New Age travellers of today.
When you were arrested and interrogated, this was right after the Prevention of Terrorism Act was passed, which enabled the authorities to keep somebody suspected of terrorism for 7 days without legal representation. So that was the period when you were arrested. Can you remember for us the moment when you decided, okay, I'll sign this confession?
When Wally Simmons, the police officer, and Christopher Rowe, who was the assistant chief constable, they picked up the phone and spoke to the policeman who had brutalised me in Springfield Road Police Station and said, Conlon hasn't made a confession. We want an accident to happen to his family. And then they started going on mentioning members of my family. And, like, I knew that the threat was a real one because so many civilians had been killed in such strange circumstances by the security forces, and none of the security forces had ever been held answerable. So, like, I knew that the threat was totally real. And although I was being brutalised within the police station, it was then taken out of my hands. I couldn't deal with the likes of my father, my mother or my sisters being murdered because I wouldn't make a confession. And I thought that the confession would never have stood up in court because of the background I had.
Did you name names, other people's names, when you were asked to confess?
We all named names. We all named the most ludicrous names we could imagine. We named people who were alcoholics, people who were drug addicts. We named every sort of name, you know?
Did you mention your aunt?
I did mention my aunt, you know? And I was only a kid at the time. You've got to remember that we were all 18, 19 and 20 years of age. None of us had ever been in this type of situation before. We were being brutalized. We were being terrified.
Yeah.
We were being held naked. So you had very immature kids, you know?
So your aunt and her family were actually imprisoned for several years and found guilty of being bomb makers, of running a bomb-making factory out of their homes.
That's right. But my other aunt and uncle had been arrested a couple of days previous to that, you know, and the fact is that the police fabricated evidence against my Aunt Annie and my Uncle Paddy and against my father and against my cousins. You know, they went and done a test called the TLC test, the thin layer chromatography test, and once they got the results of that, they said that there was confirmation that they'd been handling explosives, and immediately they burned the samples.
What happens is, basically, we all assume in our own ignorance that if we were in a police station, A, we wouldn't sign a confession,
mm-hmm.
and B, we wouldn't tell on their, you know, friends or whatever. But if most people were terrorized, and it doesn't even have to be such beatings, you know, it can be psychological. Most people would confess. It's something they don't want to admit to. And what happens consequently is we make that act, which is totally understandable, into something wrong. So we're victimizing the victims all over again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the frightening thing is not that these people were framed by the police. I can understand that if I can't condone it. But the frightening thing is that the police could think that these people were the IRA. That the police were so blind to, you know, both what the IRA is and what Irish people are, that they thought these ordinary hippies on acid were bombers. It's a frightening concept.
My guest is Jerry Conlon. His autobiography is the subject of the new movie In the Name of the Father. The film's director, Jim Sheridan, is also with us. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jerry Conlon, whose autobiography is the basis of the new film In the Name of the Father. Director Jim Sheridan is also with us. Jerry, how did your father end up going to prison?
Well, my father had this tremendous love for me, you know, and my mother was the only person in the house who was working at the time, and she couldn't afford to take time off to come and organize a solicitor. But the thing that's important here is that my father actually went to the police station in Belfast, where I had been detained and beaten, and he got the police to make a call to Scotland Yard that they announced that he was coming over and where he would be staying, which is my aunt's house. And that Scotland Yard police said, yes, of course Mr. Conlon can come over to get legal representation for his son. And when my father arrived in the country, he was in the country 4 hours and they arrested him. Now, is that the actions of someone who's got something to hide or who's conspiratorial? They actually called Scotland Yard and warned them in advance that he's coming. And
what happened was
because they needed to build a case. And I think it went a bit further than that. I think it was like the British police send to the Irish community. If you have the IRA in your midst, we are going to find you guilty as well. And therefore, they terrorized the minority community. You know, that's the reality of the situation.
So your father came to visit you and to try to get you good legal representation.
My father came.
And he was picked up when he
My father came to meet police at Scotland Yard to find out what was happening to me. And he mm-hmm. met them in the most bizarre circumstances as a suspect who was then being charged.
So were you on good terms with your father then?
I had the relationship that most young people have with their father, you know, which is a rebellious one. He was the head of the household who laid down laws for the household. And obviously, being a teenager, I rebelled against him from time to time. But there was a great love between me and my father.
So how has your relationship changed when you ended up in jail together?
Well, it went from extreme to extreme, you know. Like, my father believed in one course of action to deal with trying to prove our innocence, and I believed in another. And at time we came into conflict about it. But, like, there was always this love, and I got to see my father beyond the superficial father that most children see. I got to know him as a human being. I got to see a spiritual side of him, and I got to be able to dip from the well of strength that he had inside him, you know.
In your book, you write that before your father died, he said to you, and your father died in prison. When he got to prison, he had, I think, tuberculosis and a heart condition. So he was
he hadn't got a heart condition.
He didn't
my father,
have heart, okay.
The thing is, my father would have probably been alive today if it hadn't have been for the mild treatment in prison. You know, like, if you would have been, if you had treated a dog in the fashion that the British prison authorities treated my father, you would have been indicted. My father was treated brutally at the hands of the British.
You write that your father said to you before he died, my death is going to clear your name, then you clear mine. Did his death have an effect on your case?
I think the death of my father reopened this case. It drew enormous interest to the case, and I think my father's death was instrumental in my release. And I think since I've been out of prison, I've campaigned ferociously on behalf of innocent victims of miscarriages of justice, and not only in the Irish community, but in the black community, in the Asian community. And I have gone out and told the world what's happened to my father, and I'm just trying to do my best now for other people who are left behind in prison suffering the same injustice.
So you think even in death your father was helping you?
Oh, I know in death. My father gave his life to not only clear my name, but to clear the names of the likes of Annie McGuire in that door. Without my father's death, this case would never have been reopened.
Annie McGuire.
He gave the ultimate sacrifice.
In your book, you write, I'd gone away as a kid, an absolute menace. I came out of prison more mature. How did you mature in prison?
Well, I think 15 years anywhere. Like,
yeah, really?
No matter where you are, I think if you're in a zoo, you mature to some extent, you know, to some extent.
Yeah.
And what happened was I started educating myself while I was in prison, no thanks to the prison authorities, I might add, but through my family sending me in books and all sorts of reading material and newspapers and that they sacrificed bits of their savings for. And I think it was just a growing up process. It's a very difficult place to become mature. But it happens to everyone. You do become mature. Time's the master.
Three of your friends, plus your aunt and her family, were imprisoned for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Did they all survive emotionally and physically?
No, I think everybody's been deeply scarred by this trauma. And my lawyer in England took me to a psychologist, and she said it'll take 20 years for the scars to sort of heal in this situation. And everyone's deeply scarred, but the situation's developing because of this film. Like, what the British press are trying to do is pit victim against victim, you know, which is a real sad state of affairs when you have people who have been acknowledged to have been brutalised and went through some of the worst conditions imaginable in that country, and then use them as a scapegoat to justify your own institutions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Conlon, and he is the subject of the new film In the Name of the Father, which stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Jerry Conlon. Jerry Conlon and several of his friends and family were basically framed for the bombing of two London pubs in, was it 1974?
It was 1974, and it wasn't basically framed, it was totally framed.
Thank you. And there was evidence that corroborated their story that was suppressed by the prosecution.
There was evidence the whole way through the thing. It was from the day after my arrest, the forensic and after scenes policemen had material at their fingertips that suggested they had got the wrong people. And even during my trial, the people who actually bombed Guildford and Woolwich, left a bomb in Margaret Thatcher's constituency, which was an absolute replica of the bomb that they placed in Guildford without a detonator. And the forensic people who had just given evidence the day before on behalf of the prosecution, in my case, went and examined that bomb and then wrote a thesis saying that the people who have done the Guildford and Woodledge pub bombings are still at large, and they did not reveal that evidence to our defence. The police acted totally dishonourable, and so did the defence, or so did the prosecution in our case.
And even when the real bombers confessed to the bombing,
the real,
it was ignored.
When the Balcombe Street people were arrested, they were asked by the heads, Jim Neville, Peter Imbert, in the interrogation, what was the first bombings you did in this country? And they said, the first bombings we did in this country, you put innocent people in prison for. And they proceeded to give an enormous amount of detail. The police chose to do nothing about that. When the Balcombe Street people then got in touch with an MP, they were charged with Guildford and Woolwich and were charged for several months. They were then taken to a special court hearing with the charges, seven murder charges, were then dropped against them, with the statement from the DPP, who is your equivalent of your DA, stating that they did not want to burden the jury with too many charges. They then kept in several complex conspiracy charges, which those people were found not guilty of. The Balcombe Street people, or the IRA unit, then used their trial as a platform to highlight the injustice it had suffered us and the corruption of the British police and the British judiciary. And on the basis of that, we were given an appeal.
Jerry, you've said that you don't want to go through your whole life just being known as one of the Guildford Four. What have you been doing lately?
I've been campaigning. 2 weeks after I got out of prison, I was in Washington campaigning on behalf of other victims of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been doing. But I feel that, or I felt that I had to fulfill my father's promise, which was to let the world know what had happened to him. And the two mediums for doing that is literature and the cinema. After this movie's over, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I will always be involved in human rights issues, that's for sure, because I know what it's like to fall foul of the law when you're innocent.
Jerry Conlon's autobiography In the Name of the Father is the basis of the new movie of the same name. The director of the film, Jim Sheridan, will be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.